You're listening to Canada's most listened to spiritual talk show. And now, here's your host, Drew Marshall.
Wish that guy was a little more exciting.
Yeah, really.
I gotta say, this is one of my favorite songs off James Taylor's album, October Road. Beautiful lyrics.
I forget what to ask for. There isn't anything I haven't been given. How could I wish for anything more? As I am here living in heaven, this moment in the sun, to feel the wheel turning on.
All right, folks, you are listening to The Drew Marshall Show. We're streaming live at drewmarshall.ca. We're on Real Radio here in Southern Ontario, Joy 1250 on your FM dial.
As opposed to fake radio?
Listen, this is real radio. Because, you know, there's a lot of podcasts out there. You know, guys just doing their shows out of their mom's basements, you know. So, a little awkward. My son is here with me for our Thanksgiving Day special. Tim the Tool is away. And one of my favorite guests over the years is on the phone at this particular moment. And I'm thrilled to have her. Kay Warren. Hi, Kay.
Kay, happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, A. Thanks, A. When was the last time you were up here?
About a year ago. I got, I taped something at 100 Huntley Street, and yeah, that was a nightmare flight. We missed it in California, you know, missed it in Denver, missed connections, got to Winnipeg at like midnight. And, of course, our bags hadn't kept up with us, and so we had no luggage, but I was going to be taping TV shows the next morning at 8 o'clock. So we made a Walmart. I am so, talking about being thankful, I am thankful for Walmart, because we went to Walmart. We outfitted ourselves from shoes to makeup. We combed the last of their fresh fruit aisles and got back to our hotel at 2 a.m. with our little leftover chips and dead yogurt and
Sorry. Did you say dead yogurt? What kind of yogurt?
Well, it was just past its prime.
Oh,
I don't know.
That's gross.
It was. Yeah,
but isn't that the definition of yogurt? It's cream gone past its prime, right? Isn't that it?
Well, yeah, technically, I suppose that's true. But I'm grateful. I'm grateful for Walmart there in Canada.
I don't like a lot of preachers. I don't get to know a lot of preachers' wives, and those that I do, I like even less. But you and I'm just in love with you guys, and I don't want to sound too mushy, but I really like you guys. That's all.
I think I'm supposed to say thank you.
Oh, I noticed the awkward silence at the end of that one. Hey, listen, let's get into why you're here today. Yesterday, October 10th, was World Mental Health Day. More than 400 million people worldwide living with a mental illness? Seriously?
Yep. And, in the United States, and I'm sure it's pretty close to Canada, it seems to be a worldwide number. About 1 in 4 people will experience a mental illness in a given year.
But you know, Kay, that a lot of people listen to that, and depending on what generation they're of, they hear that and they go, well, geez, everybody's saying this is mental illness and that's a mental illness. And back in our day, it wasn't a mental illness. You know, you just got over it. It seems like everybody's hanging their hat on the mental illness tag. How do you push back on that?
Well, I'd say that's just a 1 in 4 who have a diagnosable illness. That doesn't account for all the, you know, people who, it's a spectrum. Hmm. You know, it's a spectrum. And so, you know, if you lose your job, you're going to probably feel down and depressed for a while. And that's a normal human response. And that's not considered a mental illness. It's a mental illness when on that spectrum the effects of it begin to, you know, reach into your job, reach into your family, reach into your ability to live normal life, and that's when it becomes something that is worth worrying about, worth being concerned about. Anybody can feel down for a whole number of reasons or feel anxious. You know, you've got a job interview. Most of us get butterflies in our stomachs. That's not mental illness. It's when it begins to interfere with the functioning of daily life that we have to be concerned. And there are many, many, many millions of people living in that place.
Okay, you you have talked about some of your struggles as well, and I want to talk specifically about how obviously the church is handling mental illness, and it seems hold on, let me just back this up. Let's face it, there are some churches, some denominations in particular, I think, Kay, that still teach that if you just do X or just pray Y or just right. Have more of Z. Then you'll be healed, right? Getting healed, getting fixed is their primary message. And if you don't get healed or get fixed, then directly or indirectly, it's somehow your fault. And that is just rubbish.
Absolutely it is. And that perpetuates the stigma. That's probably, if you were to cut to the chase and say, what can every church do? Every church can remove the stigma from having a mental illness. If my thyroid goes haywire, which it has, and I'll take thyroid medication for the rest of my life, nobody looks down on me or puts me down for that. But if your brain doesn't function right, or it somehow gets out of whack, or there's things that happen and there's brain injury, then all of a sudden we feel the freedom to stigmatize people and say that, as you said, that it's their fault. They aren't trying hard enough, or they aren't trusting God enough. And that's just, you said rubbish, I'd say baloney. It's false. It's stupid.
Okay, why aren't preachers talking about it? I mean, are they not getting any training in Bible colleges, seminaries on this stuff?
Very little. Very little. It's sad. It's more than sad. It's tragic. There isn't an awful lot of emphasis in most seminary educations around mental illness or how to counsel people or how to work with them. And yet, if you ask the average pastor of a church of 100, what are the phone calls that, he gets that comes across the desk, most of them are going to be people in crisis, and a large percentage of those are going to be in some way affected by either addiction or mental illness, and that's what's precipitated the crisis. So it's not like you have to tell pastors, oh, this is a new thing you need to start being concerned about. No, this is what you're dealing with every single day. You just may not recognize it.
I think one of the realities, actually, after Robin Williams committed suicide, I was asked to co-host a show in the Toronto area, kind of a big station with some friends of mine, and they asked me about my suicide attempt many, many years ago, and we talked about, what is it about our culture, what is it about us that we just don't handle this stuff really well. So it's not just the church, Kay. Our society in general doesn't handle it that well. And I think there's a couple of main reasons. One is it's not a quick fix. You can't fix it quickly. So, geez, what do I do about that? And number two, we don't do well with stuff that's invisible, period. Period.
Yeah, stuff below the waterline.
Yeah. And, if I walked, you just said this kind of thing. If I walked around and I had an amputated arm, people would be able to kind of, oh, I see. And can I help you with this? And da-da-da-da-da. And they can see my injury. They can see my illness. But that stuff that's buried inside, man.
Well, I've heard mental illness called the no casserole illness. If I was diagnosed, just what you said, if you had a limb missing or I was diagnosed with cancer, when I was diagnosed with cancer, we had people bringing meals for months. But if I also had announced, I have bipolar, I am bipolar, or I have borderline personality disorder, or I have schizophrenia, or I have major depression, nobody's going to bring me a casserole. And yet the illnesses are the same. Our body, we're a whole. That's such a misunderstanding. We're a whole. We're body, mind, and spirit, and every part of us can get ill or out of whack. And so the powerful message that we want to say to the church, but to the world at large, is if you can remove the stigma, you can make a huge dent in caring for people with mental illness. The church is a legitimizing agent in society.
Yep.
And it can either delegitimize you or legitimize you. And when the church says you are welcome, you are warmly embraced, you belong here, and on top of that you have a valuable contribution to make, then people with mental illness will start feeling freer to share, families will get the support that they need, and we can knock down that wall.
A website for you to go to if you're interested in this discussion is mentalhealthandthechurch.com, mentalhealthandthechurch.com. You will find an incredible amount of resources here, and this will empower you and help you and your church and your community to move forward in this issue. Kay, the responsibility, we're talking about the responsibility of the church leadership really needing to shoulder on this whole issue. I mean, it's one of the last carpet sweeping issues the church has, right? Mental health.
Yes.
But let's talk about that responsibility. So preachers aren't preaching about it. Theological seminaries aren't training people about it. When we bring people up on the platform at the front of a church, it's usually a glory story as opposed to a messy story. I used to be this. I used to struggle with that. I mean, Kay, you even said it in an interview I saw. You said, you know, yeah, I've even struggled with a depression. You said it as, you know, like it's cleaned up and it's in the past. It was a past tense thing.
Oh, well, let me correct that. It is not past.
Good
it's
for you.
Current.
Good for you. Yeah. See, this is what I get in trouble for here. When I come out and I say, I am not convinced. I'm not 100% convinced anymore that there's a God. People are like, whoa, you need to just turn off your microphone, go away, get fixed. And when you're really sure that there's a God, come back and turn the microphone on again. And I think that's one of the issues that pastors around the world are screwing up our congregation's subconscious. They are subconsciously thinking, the only stories I hear up there are fixed stories. So I'm not fixed.
Yeah,
man, I'm screwed up.
That's tragic, because the reality is we're all messy. And anybody who says that we're not hasn't either taken a look in the mirror today or hasn't looked across the breakfast table at their roommate or their wife or their kid, because we're just all glorious messes. And I don't know why we do that. I think maybe we're afraid that if we don't present, it's such a dance. I don't know, I'm thinking of a million things at once here, but it's such a dance, because the scripture is clear that we're supposed to live a life in front of. James 1 talks about in the Message paraphrase, it says, you know, when you go through hard times, your faith life is exposed. And it's exposed, and people can see what it really consists of. And so there's this responsibility, I think, we feel to make sure that we're giving an accurate picture to a watching world that, yes, it does make a difference to go through tragedy with Jesus Christ as opposed to not. But at the same time, we are broken and wounded. I mean, I'm thinking of when our son took his life last year. It was the most visible, it offered us the most opportunity we'd ever had for our faith life to be exposed. And I have to tell you, I found a lot of holes in my faith. I found a lot of holes, and I wasn't as strong as I thought I was. I wasn't as close to God as I thought I was. And yet I knew that truly a watching world wanted to know, how does a person who claims the name of Jesus Christ face the suicide of their child? What does it look like? What does it do to you? How do you go? Do you curse God and die? Do you walk away? And so I feel that, and I know it. And what I've tried to do is to be completely honest. People ask me, have you gotten angry at God? And I'm like, absolutely. I've beat on his chest. But for me, Drew, at the end of the day, there's nowhere else to go. There's nowhere else to go.
Well, okay.
It's not like walking away. Oh, over there is the answer. Over there is going to give me peace. There's nowhere else to go.
But that makes it sting even more, doesn't it? In other words, it's like a husband and wife. It's like a marriage. I'm trapped. There's nowhere else to go. It makes the sting even more.
I see what you're saying, and you could look at it like that, and that is one way to look at it. I have looked at it as there truly isn't anywhere else that offers me hope. Let me tell you something. There have been plenty of atheists who've written horrible things to us about people who've said they're atheists, who have said, you will never see your son again. It's done. It's over.
That's nice.
Might as well get on with your life. You will never see him again. Well, I tell you, my hope is because I know I will see him again. Mm-hmm. I will see him again. Jesus rose from the dead, and because Jesus is alive, Matthew is alive. And if Jesus and Matthew are alive, I will be alive too when I leave this life. There is nowhere else that offers hope. Nowhere.
Kay, can you do me a favor? Can you send me the names and addresses of those people that wrote those things to you?
Those are the mild things.
Okay, well, give me the worser stuff too, because you guys are, and that's a real word, by the way, you guys are pastors and nice people and public figures and stuff, but people don't care about me. I'll visit them.
That's a whole nother subject of the way that I think I don't know, it breaks my heart. It's the coarsening and the horrendous cruelty that people use through the anonymity of the web.
Totally.
And, it breaks my heart. And what breaks my heart even more is that when I get on Christian websites and they are ripping and tearing each other up and using the same words and the same language and the same slurs. And I just think the only thing different is supposedly these are Christians and over here these aren't, and they're both acting the same, and I want nothing to do with any of them.
When did you write Choose Joy? Was that 11?
2011.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Are we going to get a rewrite?
I'm releasing a devotional book. It'll come out, you know, the publishing world is rather slow. It will come out next October, so it's a pull some of the thoughts from Choose Joy in the devotions. You know, I haven't taught it since Matthew passed away. I've tried to live it. I've had people talk to me about it. I'm glad I wrote it when I did, because it's given me the strength that I've needed to get through his death and the mourning and figuring out a new normal. I can honestly tell you that I have cried more than I didn't know a human being could cry. At the same time, I have experienced joy. I do experience joy. It just doesn't look the way I thought it was going to.
Man. You know, there's just something, it's not irony, it's not, I don't know what it is. It's just, really, you wrote a book called Choose Joy in 2011. And then last year, your son takes his life. And, you know, I love both you guys, but I think you have more of a realist, you have more realist stuff going through your blood than Rick does.
You don't know him.
No, you are the one with, I think your testicular fortitude is fantastic.
Have you been waiting all day to use that term?
No, I use that regularly. I seriously, that's why I like you. You have this beautiful way of combining this lovely grace and warmth with a serious amount of giddy up.
I don't know even know what to say to that.
Okay, let's move on.
Frequently leave me speechless.
I want to talk about what I call target theology. I had this discussion with Stephen Curtis Chapman and his wife.
Love them.
Right. I mean, if you don't love them, you got a problem. Mm. But I said to them, because she's a realist too. She is, you and her, man, set the world on fire. I said to them, there's a thing out there that suggests that if you are in leadership in Christian ministry, that the target on the back of your head is bigger. And that means that Satan, the enemy of God, is going to try to mess you up more because you're doing more for the kingdom. You're in the front lines and blah, blah, blah. And I asked them this question. Apparently it kind of shook them afterwards. I was told that it was a kind of a, you know, it was an awkward moment. But when your child gets taken from you, theirs was through a horrible accident in their driveway.
Yep.
Yours was with suicide. What do you do with that target theology, which I think is garbage? Because why in the world? My son's right here, right in the studio, looking at me, across from me. The microphone, you want to say hi to Kay? Kay, Josh, Kay.
Hi.
Hi, Josh. I have a Josh. I like that name.
Me too.
So Josh, 25 years old, just got married. You know, he's been a hero in my life from the get-go. And if he dies, and the reason he dies is because I have a target in the back of my head, we're done. The God stuff, I'm done. Sign me out.
Yeah. Well, I think that, there's so much to say there. Try to say it succinctly. I hear what you're saying, and I know people have taught that, and I'm trying to, you know, think through Scripture. I would say, I think it's a yes and a no. So hear me out here as I just process this out loud, because I haven't thought about this in a while. I think that when people are in a place of visibility and they have a platform that allows them to have a voice louder than maybe, you know, your person that lives next door to you, that because there is influence, because there is the ability to speak to large groups of people at a time, it, in some ways it only makes sense that the enemy would try to do things to discourage and take us down. We know that he's crafty, that he's that he's wily, that he's fierce. He's the worst opponent any of us ever faced.
Yeah, but what happened to our God is an awesome God?
I wasn't finished.
Oh, sorry.
I was just kind of slowly setting this up in my head, of, you know, that it makes sense to me that the enemy would try to take out people or discourage them who have a big voice, if you will. And at the same time, God is working, and his angels, the Bible tells us his angels are with us, and I believe it. And I don't believe for a second that God turned his back when Matthew took the gun in his hand. I don't believe that he turned his back, as I know the Chapmans don't, on that day that Maria was in the driveway. I can't explain it. I can't. So let me tell you what I do with that. Because if anything, I have more questions now than I've ever had. Why couldn't we help Matthew? Why wasn't it enough? Why didn't God stop him? God could have stopped Matthew from pulling the trigger. The gun could have misfired. Why didn't this? Why wasn't I able to talk Matthew off the ledge like I did so many hundreds of times? You know, suicide leaves you with these questions that are largely unanswerable. And my faith, I'm really visible. I mean, I like tangible things. And so a friend gave me this little pot. It's a little tiny casserole dish, and that's the Le Creuset brand, which is the top brand of ceramic fired cookware, if you don't know.
Which I don't.
So I'm not trying to do product placement, but Le Creuset stands for the crucible, and it means that this cookware has gone through the most intense fire to make it be what it is. And I have felt like that is exactly what we have walked through. The worst day of my life has already happened. And I haven't known exactly what to do with it, but the things that I can't answer, I have written them out on slips of paper, and they've put in this little pot. It sits right here on my desk. Huh. I've got it right here next to where my Bible is. I'm looking at it right now. And I put the questions that I can't answer. All those things I just said to you, I don't have answers for. I don't. But those questions are in that pot, and they remind me every day of those questions. But here's the deal. It also sits right next to a box that has the words hope on it. And I think that is the essence, truly for me, of what I've learned in this year, is the essence of what it means to have faith. It's mystery combined with hope. Hope without mystery is flaky, and it's untested, and it's not stable.
Nice.
But mystery without hope leads to bleak despair. It's got to have both. And that's all I can tell you. I don't know anything about targeting. I don't know anything about this. I don't know why God allowed my son to die. I don't know why God allowed Maria to die. I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me, but I do believe and have hope that God will answer and that God is at work in ways I can't see. If I didn't believe that, I would walk away, but I do believe it.
Apparently, Matthew had this uncanny ability to walk into a room and figure out who was hurting.
He did.
What else did I miss out on by never meeting Matthew?
Sorry, I know quiet space on radio is not a good thing. He was so funny. He just was funny. One of the police officers who dealt with his case after he passed away, and they had his phone for a while. It's all this terrible stuff that you have to do. And when he gave me his phone back, he said, Matthew was funny. He said he was hilarious. I said, yes, he was, wasn't he? He had a mental illness, but he was so funny, deeply compassionate, goofy, crazy. Do you know what parkour is? You know, that Russian thing where you run up walls?
Yeah.
Okay. Matthew loved to do that. He loved to jump over the furniture at our house yelling parkour. And I know today he is running through heaven yelling parkour as he jumps over probably mountains and trees and lakes the size of the Grand Canyon. You would have loved him. He had a quirky sense of humor like you, sarcastic. So I'm going to name all these things. He was sarcastic. He was irreverent. He was quirky. He was a little off base. And he had a lot of questions that he didn't really know the answers to. But he was also deeply compassionate. And he cared very much about people and those who were suffering. And you would have loved him. And he would have loved you. You'll have fun together in heaven.
Hmm.
Make sure you look him up.
I'm okay with a bit of space. I mean, why? I'm going to rush this.
Thank you for asking about him, because he was a person. Who he is and who he was gets lost sometimes in the way that his life on Earth ended. And he's so much more than a statistic. Mm-hmm. He's so much more than a case or a patient or a diagnosis. An amazing young man. We put on his tombstone, his gravestone, compassionate warrior. Because he really was passionate about children. The world lost an incredible advocate for orphans and vulnerable children. He traveled around the world with me, and his heart was broken for them, but he didn't know what to do with his broken heart. He couldn't figure it out.
You know, there's a part of me that, I'm just trying to figure out whether this is sayable or not. Yeah, okay, so there's a part of me that that thinks, hold on. You know what, so I grew up in the funeral business, right? My father has a funeral home.
I didn't know that. Well, there was there.
Like, really? That explains everything now? The penny just dropped?
No wonder you're so messed up.
No wonder you have this offbeat sense of humor.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
But having been a pastor, having a hospital chaplain, and having grown up in the funeral industry, I've seen a lot of people during these times say a lot of dumb things to hurting people.
Yeah.
When they're in the middle of stuff. And I'm about to say one of those things, I think.
Well, then I'll forgive you ahead of time.
Okay, please. I know so many big, high-profile preachers that I hope no one goes through what you go through. But because you are the ones that are going through this, I am somewhat relieved. Because you guys stink of authenticity. My BS meters go through the roof with so many other people that are standing on the platform behind the pulpit. Always loved your authenticity, and if you know, we're going to use the whole lemon, make lemonade out of lemons thing. If God is into that business, then I'm glad I'm glad that it's you guys. I'm not glad that you guys went through. Can you hear me struggling through this?
I feel like I understand completely what you're saying.
All right.
And
okay.
I'm not offended. That didn't come close to... No, I'll tell you the one...
One pathetic attempt at someone trying to comfort you?
Oh, no, there was no attempt to comfort.
Oh.
This was one of the...
The haters?
Yeah. So this person said... person said, if you had homeschooled Matthew, if you had never let him pick up a video game, if you had fed him organic food, if you had supervised every date he ever went on, if you had been more purpose-driven in the way that you lived, Matthew would not have
been. Oh, my.
Wow.
Yes. Now, my first response to that, it took my breath away, and I thought I might vomit. My second response was I burst into laughter because it's so absurd you can't even respond.
Yeah.
I mean, really, there's really nothing that you can say.
That's just stupidity.
You can't even put words around that kind of response. So see, yours didn't even come close to that.
Well, it's not even worth responding to.
Well, and I didn't. And I quit reading. I don't even read. I don't read any of that, because all it does is raise my blood pressure and make me angry. And
doesn't help anything.
No, I've got better things to do with my life than pay attention to junk like that.
Exactly.
Well,
anyway, you can just file that one away.
No, you can't drop that on me and just expect me to move forward. That enrages me.
Well, it's don't just laugh at it, because it's just stupid. It's just stupid. People don't understand.
Well, 24 Hours of Hope. That's the broadcast. Was it everything you want? I mean, it was yesterday, so we kind of missed it by a day here. But
that's okay. The video all exists. Ooh, I had a hard time saying that. The video lives on mentalhealthinthechurch.com. All of the things that were broadcast yesterday, it's there. The resources are there. We had about 11,000 people. We were hoping for more, but, we always add zeros to things and wanted more. But it was a good learning, and there were thousands of people who watched it and were helped, and I have to believe it was a lot of seed that got planted of people believing that God hasn't abandoned them and cares about them, and that the church actually is going to take a stand toward compassion and going to start talking about how to support people living with mental illness. So we're really excited, and Matthew's death was the worst thing I could ever imagine, and it took us down to our foundations, if you will, and God's got a lot of rebuilding to do in us, but everything like that becomes a pebble on the side of bringing beauty from the terrible, terrible ashes of his death. And so I'll keep pushing.
Good for you.
Keep speaking.
You go, girl. Did I just say that?
No, you did. I just said that.
You did.
Mentalhealthandthechurch.com. Mentalhealthandthechurch.com. Go there now. Kay Warren, you know how I feel.
Thanks, Drew. And I want to say, I really want to tell you this because I mean this. I think I wrote this to you a couple months ago. When Matthew died, you emailed us. Sorry, I got a frog in my throat.
It's kind of gross.
I was going to say it's a turkey bone. You guys eat turkey on Thanksgiving?
No, what's that?
Okay, chicken or whatever you eat.
Poutine.
Okay, anyway, you wrote me and to me and Rick, and you said your email message after you heard Matthew died was, I'm going to say this, you said, "I have no words." And that's all you said. And I told you in an email months ago, and I'll tell you again, that when tragedies happen, people don't know what to do, and they don't know what to say. And you may not have felt you knew anything to say in that moment, but what you did is you did the most important thing, and you showed up. Your presence. You don't live near us, so you couldn't come to our house. You couldn't come show up at church. You couldn't give us a hug. But your email said to me and to Rick, "I'm with you. I care about you. What's happened matters to me." All of that was in what you said. And presence is the most important thing that you can give to someone who is suffering or brokenhearted or wounded. And you did it. And I thank you. I thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks. Don't make me feel awkward on air.
Not trying to. I'm just trying
to. That's my job.
I just want you to know I appreciate it.
I know.
And I count you a friend and a brother.
Thanks. Thanks, Kay. I appreciate it. Give the.
It's nice to meet you.
You too, Kay.
Give the big unit a kick up the bum for me or whatever you do.
And, Kay, let me just add, I mean, this is obviously my first time talking to you and meeting you, I guess, on the air. But I agree with what Dad said. You are just so genuine. And
you
it's
get
very,
that, right?
Oh, yeah. It's just, it's pouring out of you. So I recognize that, and I appreciate that.
Thanks, you guys.
Wow, listen to him. I'm going to take over my show. Kay, thank you. We'll talk again.
Thanks, you guys.
Bye-bye. Bye. All right, folks. We a little overtime on that one, but it wasn't going to go any other way, I think. That was, man, heart stuff. Heart and hard stuff. Stay with us.
I've seen the comet attraction, Armageddon and Waterloo. I tried to change my mind. I waste precious time. Carry me on my way.
It's hard to find quality guest speakers these days. If they're interesting, they're usually expensive. And if they're cheap, they're usually boring. Well, here's someone who's both expensive and boring. Drew Marshall is a high school dropout who tried to become a pro football player but didn't make it. He then tried to become a firefighter and didn't make it. Now he's trying to become a stand-up comic. Good luck with that, Mr. Marshall. But if you're looking for someone who's unpredictable, incredibly honest, provocative, genuine, then we've got the right guy. Everyone seems to be an expert on something these days. Why not book someone who's an expert on nothing, except how to be brutally honest about yourself and your faith? To book Drew Marshall as your guest speaker, go to drewmarshall.ca.